The following program uses what are sometimes called four-letter words, though in this case they're actually eight letters and perhaps a seven-letter gerund. It's Monday, March 31st, 2022. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The last of a trio of convicts who masterminded the largest mass kidnapping in American history is set to be paroled. Now, when I say convict and mastermind in the same sentence, you may correctly infer that his mind wasn't that masterful. But Frederick Woods, in 1976, along with two accomplices, the Schoenfeld brothers, had a plan that, if not successful, was very detailed. Lots of moving parts. So, the three set their van on a rural road, blocking the path of a bus coming back from Dairyland Elementary School in Chowchilla, California. The three boarded the bus, forcing all 26 school children and their driver off. Here, in an audio recording made a few years after the kidnapping, Jennifer Brown, who was on the bus, explains what happened next.
And there was two guys standing from the bus door to the van door with guns, with pantyhose over their heads so we wouldn't run out. And then, see, they pulled the van right up to the bus door.
That from a CBS 48 Hours report on the kidnapping. So the kids and their drivers were transported from their bus to the waiting van, as Jennifer described, to a buried moving van trailer 100 miles away. They were locked inside this trailer, underground, in a quarry, after which the kidnappers called in their reward. From there, everything went wrong. The story became national news. The entire town of Chowchilla was in an uproar. The President of the United States was alerted, as Walter Cronkite reported on the evening news.
26 school children and their bus driver have vanished. Anguished parents, President Ford, hundreds of searching police are asking the question, where are the children?
Given the panic in the community and 70s telecom technology, what happened next was both inevitable, if unforeseen, by Woods and the Schoenfeld boys. The phone lines were all jammed. The kidnappers could not phone in their ransom demand, so they napped from mastermind to sleepyheads. And when they woke up, they found out that all the children and the driver had managed to dig their way out. One Schoenfeld turned himself in. One Schoenfeld fled, and Frederick Woods was captured in Vancouver, dressed like a cowboy, because someone was obviously thinking ahead to the aesthetics of a David O. Russell movie that I can't believe hasn't been commissioned yet. The trial was almost as odd as the kidnapping. Though the defendants admitted to the crime, they did not admit to causing harm to the children during the kidnapping, arguing that the kids' scrapes and bruises did not amount to real harm. Now, of course, the jury found against them, but a California appeals court sided with the kidnappers' definition of harm, thus turning a conviction of life without the possibility of parole to life with the possibility of parole, a possibility that has been realized now for all the kidnappers, with Woods being the last one to be cleared to leave prison. In 2016, the victims also sued Woods for the psychological damage he caused. But think about it. Here's a guy who, since he was 24 years old, has spent decades in jail after being desperate enough to plot an audacious kidnapping attempt. I mean, it's not like he's sitting on a gold mine. But in fact, according to CBS, from prison, Woods was running a Christmas tree farm, a used car business, and a gold mine, the Little Bear Creek Gold Mine. Woods, now 70, has been granted parole, but is not out yet. California Governor Gavin Newsom has 120 days to release him after a maximum 30 days of review. He can refer his decision back to the whole parole board. It all just seems like a way to keep the 70-year-old in prison for a little while longer. But soon, he will be released to live not just with the terrible realization of the pain he caused, but also, reportedly, his third wife, who he married while incarcerated, a mansion near the prison, and of course, a gold mine of memories and possibly actual gold. On the show today, I spiel about the three camps of norm enforcement concerning a certain slap. But first, General James Cowan is a veteran of the British military. He is the CEO of an organization called HALO, which removes mines and unexploded ordnance from war zones. Halo had hundreds of workers inside Ukraine working to demine the Donbas after the 2014 invasion when a new war broke out. Now the general has a battle to fight on many fronts, too many of them literal. General James Cowan, CEO of Halo, up next.
Everybody, I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
The organization HALO is an acronym. It stands for Hazardous Area Life Support Organization. They address the remnants of war, the mines and the unexploded ordnance that was left behind after conflicts. In Ukraine, they are, I'll read directly from their website. Here's what they're doing right now. We're teaching children in bomb shelters how to stay safe from deadly explosives. We're distributing vital medical supplies. We are providing emergency shelters to families forced to flee the fighting, and we are tracking where explosives fall and preparing to clear the rockets and bombs when conditions allow. James Cowan, retired Major General in the British Army, is actually the only CEO of a major United Kingdom non-government organization who has served in the Army, is the chief executive of HALO. He joins me now. Thank you for joining me, General Cowan.
Call me James, please.
I shall. How many people did you have in Ukraine before the fighting started?
We had 430 staff based in the Donbass, and they had been working on clearing up the unexploded ordnance of the 2014 war. We've been there since 2016. And because we're in the Donbass, our people were based in really from the south, northwards from Mariupol. And you can imagine what that means, north up to Kramatorsk and then all the way up to the line of control. So it's a fairly major program. It's actually not our largest. Our biggest is in Afghanistan, but it's an important part of the HALO world.
What kind of unexploded ordnance or bombs were there in the Donbass before this current round of fighting started?
Well, when the fighting finished in 2014, the line of control kind of consolidated in a way that meant there were two front lines and there was the widespread use of landmines. So we were clearing anti-tank landmines, anti-personnel landmines, but also a wide range of other unexploded ordnance, artillery shells, rocketry, mortar rounds, and booby traps. Lots of widespread use of booby traps, often grenades rigged to trees with tripwires.
Were these unexploded ordnance placed there by Russian forces, irregulars, Ukrainians defending themselves against the Russians?
Yeah, a bit of both, to be honest, but largely Russian in origin, but certainly on both sides.
And just so you could give a sense to our listeners, the attraction and illegality of things like landmines and booby traps are that they're cheap and they're effective, if you want to consider what their purpose is. But they also have costs that so many other kinds of weapons don't, because with other kinds of weapons, once the soldiers leave and once you're not aiming the weapon at the population, there's no threat. That's not the case with landmines.
That's right. I mean, the landmine is a kind of, he's the soldier, he's the sentry who never comes off duty. And you can put the landmine in the ground 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years ago, And because it's a hermetically sealed plastic unit, water won't get into it, it won't rust, it won't corrode, and it will remain lethal from that day to this. So it is an extremely indiscriminate weapon designed in the first place to kill or maim people in a conflict. But actually, many years after the event, it ends up killing innocent civilians, notably children.
They're attracted to it. Also, in some of these countries, children are tasked with clearing the fields before planting. They see something shiny or just something that they want to pick up, and then they lose an arm or a life. And we'll get into the situation in Ukraine. But I want to also note that part of your organization is not just taking away danger. It's converting the places where the landmines were buried, which could be very good farming land. It's converting that to practical use, right?
That's right. I mean, what we in the UK would call a brownfield site. You know, I mean, it's contaminated land. And normally when you think about that, you're thinking about industrial contamination chemicals. But here we're removing explosive contamination. And no one will go into a field, even if it has just one landmine, you know, or 100. It doesn't matter. That landmine needs to go so that people can feel safe to farm that land. And children do go in, and they are in really poor countries tasked with harvesting precious metals. The tendency is with landmines that they're plastic and buried and therefore invisible. But the other hazard that we're dealing with in a really widespread way is aerial delivered cluster munitions. Cluster munitions don't bury in the ground. They lie on the surface. They're very shiny. They normally have a ribbon, a colored ribbon, often red, to align it in during the drop so it falls in the right alignment. And that colored ribbon and that shiny object is a very attractive sight for a child looking for a toy.
Cluster munitions are bombs that explode in midair and form smaller bomblets, these attractive to children bomblets that you talk about. And they are being used in this war. And even though they're illegal under international law, would you say that that dissuades the Russians from using them any one bit?
So they are illegal for those nations that are signatories. Russia is not a signatory.
Well, that's what a clever way out of international law not to sign the treaty. But to be fair or unfair, the United States isn't either, I don't think.
So the landmine ban treaty covers anti-personnel landmines. Doesn't actually cover anti-tank landmines. So anti-tank mines are not illegal. And both Ukraine and Russia are using them at the moment. That is just a statement of legal fact. As far as cluster munitions are concerned, there is a convention on that. But again, you know, Russia is not party to it. And there are two sorts, really, that you can think about. First of all, there's aerial delivered mines, which are anti-personnel, and they're not designed to explode. They're designed to fall and create an instant barrier. And then there are cluster munitions that are intended to explode, but very often fail. So you might get, you know, in a cluster munition drop, a 20% failure rate. So you will have a great many munitions on the ground. It is actually an aspect of this war that is extremely interesting, is the degree to which Russian munitions are failing to work. So we don't just do landmines and cluster munitions. We do all sorts of bombs and artillery ammunition. 60% of Russian bombs dropped from aircraft are failing to detonate. And 60% is a huge number. So these are wedged in buildings. You could really make an entire block of flats, of apartments, completely uninhabitable until, you know, a 500-pound bomb is defused. So that there's a major, major task to deal with these munition types in urban areas. And it's one thing to clear a two-dimensional field, but a three-dimensional building is a lot harder.
In my imagination, your work is that you come in after the fighting is done, largely, and clear the area. But here you are in the middle of the fighting. You and your people were caught up in it. How unusual is that for your organization?
So actually not that unusual. I mean, our biggest program, as I mentioned, is Afghanistan. We've operated in Afghanistan since 1988. Arguably, since August, this is the first time since that date there's been no fighting in Afghanistan. So we've been there and been able to.
It's almost literally a Sisyphean task for you guys.
So, you know, we're there doing that work, and we understand how to work in conflict. But the big difference, of course, between Afghanistan and Ukraine is that Afghanistan was an insurgency, a low-intensity war waged by the Taliban against first Western forces and then the old government. And it was largely about men with AK-47s and the laying of IEDs, improvised explosive devices. So quite low intensity. This is, in Ukraine, a high-intensity conflict waged by a highly industrialized army in extremely densely populated urban environments, using the whole range of artillery, rockets, landmines, long-range weapon systems that is completely different from Afghanistan.
Tell me about the safety of your people inside Ukraine.
Yeah, well, it's been a massive worry for us this last month. We, as I said, you know, we're working in the east, so very much, very, very close to the line of control. 21 of our staff became trapped in Mariupol, became extremely difficult to communicate with them. Mobile phone signals were very, very rare and intermittent. We've had a few messages. We've had have described scenes of absolute devastation and, to use the word, I mean, a living hell. And it has been extremely hard for our people in Mariupol. Only four of them, to our knowledge, have escaped so far. And we remain extremely worried about the safety of those that remain. And we just don't know. At the time of speaking, I have no idea whether they're alive and well or not. And my thoughts, you know, constantly with them.
I've seen scenes of rockets wedged into the ground, unexploded, in urban settings. When that happens, does the Ukraine military know what to do? Do they talk to you about how to address these rockets that are right there that could explode at any moment or if handled improperly?
Yeah, so perhaps I could wind back a little bit. I mean, we're examining this in the following way. Essentially, we found ourselves as a post-conflict organization having to deal with a live conflict. And we've got an organization that's sort of almost in the wrong place. We're in the east and we need to rebuild in the west of the country so that we can have a safe operating base from which to work outwards. So the situation is I'm in the process of pivoting my organization from east to west and then building from there. We've done incredibly well with fundraising. People and organizations have been incredibly generous and have, you know, realized the seriousness of what's going on. So once we've done that, then we're looking at three scenarios. The scenario one is where the Russians realize they can't win and they look for peace terms and leave. In that situation, we're in a position to work pretty much in the whole of free Ukraine. In scenario two, Mr. Putin goes for the partition of Ukraine, and we're in a position to operate in the free half of the country. And in scenario three, he goes for broke and he tries to take down the whole country. I think during the last few days, we would say the following, that scenario one is highly desirable, but not very likely. Scenario two is less undesirable, but quite likely. And scenario three is highly undesirable, but fortunately, not very likely. So we're beginning to basically focus our planning on that second scenario of partition.
And I would guess in the last few days, your assessment of the likelihood of scenario three has changed.
Correct. I mean, my sense is that he probably still harbors a long-term ambition to take down the whole country. I don't believe him when he says he's given up on taking Kyiv. I actually think that is the classic Soviet era doctrine of Maskarovska, i.e. Military deception, and using language to deceive. So I'm, extremely skeptical about anything that he says. So I do think in the long term, they still harbor that desire to take the whole country, and he's willing to play the long game because, you know, he has played the long game in other places such as Chechnya and Syria. So we should not imagine this is all going to end beautifully in the next few days. But for now, at least, it looks like, at least in the short term, he has, to use the military phrase, culminated. He does not have the logistics or the combat power to prosecute the war on several fronts at once, and that perhaps he will, therefore, focus on the Donbass. Therefore, all the more reason why, given my my organization's base in Kramatorsk, that I'm keen to pivot my people so that I can reconstitute the program to deliver the humanitarian service that we provide.
I want to talk about getting relief efforts in. I would imagine to the western part or to some places it's possible, and to Mariupol obviously it's not, but could you give us an update when, if and when people donate to your organization or other organizations, can those materials, relief materials, actually get into the people who need them?
So I don't think you can get anything into anyone unless two things happen. First of all, there's a ceasefire, and both sides agree to allow that to happen. And I think it's extremely questionable whether the Russians will agree to that. But it might be possible that it does happen. And if it does, you know, I think that would be a fine humanitarian thing for them to do. I don't believe all Russians are bad. I think there are many Russians appalled by what's going on. And I'm sure many of them would want to see aid delivered to these people who are so desperate for it. The second thing that needs to happen is that it's actually safe. Even if people give permission to move down a corridor, it needs to be safe. And we're the organization that is there to prove that routes are safe. You know, we've got the experience. We do surveys, a massively important part of our work. And then when we find a device, whether it be an unexploded rocket or a shell or whatever, then we can dispose of it quickly and thereby allow the aid convoy in. So I think those things are really vital and will be, I hope, an important part of the character of this conflict in the next few days.
Yeah, so I'll just put this to you. I wanted to donate, and I was actually saying to myself, well, we can donate relief. I found that your organization was making a call for flak jackets and bulletproof vests. You know, a certain dollar donation could buy that. And I thought that was good. But I did say to myself, I think what they really need is weapons, which is not in keeping with what NGOs do, but is in keeping with the idea of defense. So if a person were to say to you, what I think the Ukrainians really need is to take the fight to the Russians, what would you say to convince me still your humanitarian aid goes far?
There are 42 million people, I believe, in Ukraine, who about 1 million of them have now left and are living in Poland and other bordering countries. So that means there are 41 million people in desperate need of support. You know, it's not for me as a humanitarian to talk about the weapons that are used in this conflict, but I don't think anyone could argue that their safety is absolutely paramount. And that there are now women, children, and men who are not in the fight, who are on a daily basis exposed to the most extraordinary and terrible conditions. So the sooner we can help clear this explosive ordnance and make their lives safe, the better. So I absolutely passionately believe that the public in your country, in my country, and elsewhere around the world are incredibly generous and want to see this dealt with, and that, you know, our work is absolutely central to that. And it's not just that, you know, by clearing a landmine you stop someone being killed. By clearing a landmine you also make it safe to go back into your house or to have an aid convoy delivered with food, with medicine, you know, and other humanitarians can go about their work safely. So we're an essential enabler to that.
James Cowan, Major General in the British Army, is the CEO of HALO, the HALO Trust, working to address the weapons of war that remain behind and the war that is ongoing and affecting his people in country right now. James, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Mike.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general. And he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, this is Rachel Yucatel, and I'm here to invite you to listen to my podcast, Misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. This podcast delves into the lives of those who have been reduced to a single headline. Each episode will take a closer look at the stories of those who are on a mission to change their narrative. Join me as we uncover the truth behind the misconceptions, shed light on the stories of those who have perhaps been wrongfully portrayed, explore the complexities of the human experience, and celebrate the power of second chances. Who doesn't love a good comeback story?
And now the spiel. Earlier in the week, I was reading the responses to one of my tweets about Chris Rock being slapped by wife guy Will Smith, and I saw a range of opinions there. Will was way out of control. Chris was way out of line. If Will was really that out of line, Chris's jaw would have been too. But Will laughed. But she scowled. But she has alopecia. But he doesn't have a medical chart of the entire audience. But she said it on her podcast. But there's no way he listens to that podcast. All opinions, and opinions can't be wrong, except this one. Come on, we'll all forget about this by Wednesday. I knew that would be inaccurate, but to show you what level of control and commitment to solid confirmation I have, I waited until Thursday to say so. Of course the slap was going to lodge in the collective imagination for a while. In order to get a gauge on just how big it is, I sought out a news organization that's not necessarily known for celebrity news, but isn't not known. Of course, the magazine Variety is going to have 100 stories on the slap. And of course, you know, you figure the Wall Street Journal is going to go much heavier on inflation in Ukraine. So I was seeking out a middle ground. New York Magazine. They cover celebrities, but they also cover local news. And Mayor Adams is clearing homeless encampments to much notice. They cover national news. They very much cover anything that might portend of Trump's downfall. That's always popular over there. They cover lifestyle stuff, usually with a headline announcing that the writer is so here for mom jeans or the vibe shift or the great resignation or whatever. So New York Magazine's top five most read stories today. One, where is Chris Rock? Two, AOC's warning for Democrats, we're in trouble. Three, Zoe Kravitz has waded into the slap discourse. Four, a timeline of Will, Jada, and August's entanglement. Five, Chris Rock has addressed the slap. If they could have gotten one, where's Chris Rock, to find out about five, Chris Rock has addressed the slap, they could have saved everyone a lot of time. But that, of course, is the opposite of the point, isn't it? By the way, why was AOC up there? Because AOC is to New York Magazine what the Yankees are to the New York Post's back page. New York Magazine has three politics sections: national, international, and AOC. By the way, remember when I said Wall Street Journal, they're going to be covering inflation? Two of the Wall Street Journal's top five read stories. One, what comes next for Will Smith after the Oscar slap, Hollywood's big mystery. And then five, Will Smith faces disciplinary action from Academy for slapping Chris Rock at Oscars. The Wall Street Journal has a more conservative readership slightly than other national newspapers, so it's not surprising that disciplining Will Smith as the wrongdoer resonated with their readers. That's generally how conservative sites like the Daily Wire are playing this, that Smith somehow got away with a crime, and that Hollywood has poor values. But more progressive outlets, they're mixed and a little torn. The Academy itself, which is a progressive institution, more so in 2022 than they were before, the Academy issued a statement saying, quote, Mr. Smith's actions at the 94th Oscars were a deeply shocking, traumatic event to witness in person and on television. Traumatic, that was the same word used by one of the three hosts of the ceremony, Wanda Sykes, when she appeared on the Ellen DeGeneres show.
And it was sickening. It was absolutely, I physically felt ill, and I'm still a little traumatized
by
it.
Me too.
That embodies the most dominant norm that is on display, anti-violence. Americans generally do not believe in violence as a means to settling insults. The appropriate response to words is not an act of violence. In this case, say 61% of Americans who, according to a YouGov poll, answered that Smith's actions were wrong, and only 21% say they were right. But another poll, asked a slightly different way by David Shore of Blue Rose, came out with the findings that 52% said that Chris Rock was more wrong, but among people with four-year degrees, it was 60% saying Will Smith was more wrong, pretty much matching the YouGov poll, 60% saying Will Smith more wrong than Chris Rock. I don't know how much faith to put in these Insta polls, but I do know the norm against violence does go up the higher you go up the ladder in terms of education or income. I also know that there are two other big norms at play, and they're drawn from groups that don't usually have much overlap. There was the don't make fun of a person with the disability of alopecia argument. I call this the anti-ableism norm. But then there was the don't make fun of a man's wife norm. Normally, there isn't much overlap between people who tweet using the word ableism and people who tweet using the phrase bitch slap. But in this case, we're seeing the overlap. There were a lot of strong sentiments from men about protecting women and from women about wanting to be protected by men. Certainly, there were also a lot of women who said, if my husband did that on my behalf, I'd be disgusted. But I would surmise the vast majority of those women are already covered under the anti-violence norm. The protect the wife crowd had their critics who called that attitude paternalistic. But there was another common sentiment among those who would normally deride and decry paternalism, and that sentiment is the stand up for black women argument. This is a fascinating cultural event because of all the cross currents and sentiment, what political scientists call cross pressures. I think there are a lot of cross pressures with so many political issues, like someone's kind of against Title IX, but is also very much against the trans woman benefiting from Title IX, or someone who says, I hate Russian aggression, but I don't want Joe Biden to get a foreign policy win. Normally, in our political discourse, the cross pressures are resolved, or maybe better said, refracted into those red and blue teams that stand for so much and do so much of the messy work of sorting out ambiguities for us. But with Chris Rock and Will Smith, the camps aren't as clear. Republican v. Democrat, that's salient. Less so with Fresh Prince versus Everybody Hates Chris. And as far as that last sentiment goes, we know it's not everybody or even most people, depending on polling firm and time slot. And that's it for today's show. Corey Warr is the assistant producer of The Gist. Joel Patterson, he's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca is special rapporteur for Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umperu deperu duperu, and thanks for listening.